All right, all set?
We're on.
Look at that. See, that makes me feel better. I like that.
What's that?
That you just fixed your hair a little bit.
I just saw like a big alfalfa cowlick sticking up, so I was like.
I know, but you're from Hollywood.
I'm from Mount Lebanon, suburb of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Mount Leba, dude. Dude, I know you where you're from. You're from Mount Leba.
And you're from down there in Wilkinsburg.
Dude, down by Turtle Creek.
Yeah, Turtle Creek's real nice.
Dude, like, what's the difference between the two of us? We're two handsome devils with beards from Pittsburgh, and now we landed in Hollywood.
Got the IROC off of blocks, drove down there. Donzie's for ladies' night.
Swung by the O, got down to Dirty O
up at CMU.
You know what I'm talking about.
Up where the K-Theaters are at.
This dude knows. Yeah, dude. You didn't see that game last year when the Brownies was playing.
Roethlisberger, man, you're talking about the tie game.
Dude.
Game. That's like a loss for the Steelers.
That was no good, but in that game, that Myles Garrett dude and some of them Brownies is chasing Roethlisberger around, and they're like, we're going to get it. And he shove him off. And then he just won it to the end zone. Touchdown, dude. Oh,
man, Myles Garrett's a beast. Dude's hitting L.A. Fitness out in Bridgeville.
Dude, I hate to say it.
At least three times a week.
I hate to say it, dude, but I wish he were on the Steelers.
Oh, man. He's a beast.
He's no mean Joe.
David. Football David. The Dave Dameshek Football Program. Available on Apple Podcasts and at NFL.com/DDFP. Now here's your host, Dave Dameshek.
Hey, anyway, look who it is, everybody. And hi and hello and welcome to the Dave Dameshek Football Program. Presented by Amazon Prime Video's The Boys. This is a grand idea for a show. These are superheroes, you see. But they're more selfish with their powers. They don't do what most superheroes do. And a guy who knows about superpowers and about making his own movies, he is the star, he is the creator of his own movie that's having great success so far on iTunes, the number one sports movie, bottom of the ninth. He's also been voted the greatest werewolf of all time, and he is the voice of a character on Blazing the Monster Machines. He's done it all. It's Joe Manganiello, dude.
Well, it's Manganiello.
Manga.
Yeah, I mean, Don Aaron and McKees Rocks, they do the soft G, but up in Mount Lebanon.
Not me, dude.
It's a hard G.
Now I'm going to get the shame sweats. Right up. Now I'm going to get the shame sweats. For real, before we go any further, to show how thorough a preparer,
yes,
for interviews as I am, I confirmed with six different people. I'm like, because I've heard it both ways. Please tell me how it is. And so I went with the wrong pronunciation.
Number one, fire all six of those people. Number two, I'll give you my number if you ever have a question. Now, because we got to hang out. We got to watch games. We got to go to games.
There is something about it. I know, and we're going to get into the movie. I want to hear all about the whole life, or as much as we can squeeze in the next few minutes. But it is weird that, correct me if I'm wrong, anecdotally, people from Pittsburgh are prouder of their hometown, prouder of it, than any other city. I mean, people from New York think that New York City is the only place that matters, but that doesn't necessarily equal the same civic pride that people have.
No, there's nothing like the pride of Pittsburgh. You don't say anything bad. I mean, the classic Taylor example of that is Sienna Miller shooting Mysteries of Pittsburgh by Michael Chabon and referring to it as Pittsburgh in Rolling Stone magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And then being shunned by the city. There was a bouncer in the South Side that gave her a really hard time after that because she wanted to showed her ID, or she didn't have her ID. She tried to go into a bar. He's like, hey, you know, you got to give me your ID. And she's like, well, I don't have it. And he's like, well, then I can't let you in. And she said, well, don't you know who I am? Mm. And then I guess the crew made T-shirts of Don't You Know Who I Am with her face on it. Like, it's just kind of, you don't do that in Pittsburgh. You just be a cool person and, you know, mm-hmm. try to, you don't throw that card around.
I completely agree with that. I also, I mean, the people who have gone out of their way to disparage the city apparently don't like the Ferris wheel, because that's where it was created, Pittsburgh, PA. They don't like organ transplantation. Also, first done by Dr. Thomas Starzl in Pittsburgh, PA.
Cadaver surgery, knee surgery, yeah. Well, so to finish the Sienna Miller part of it, she went back to film Foxcatcher years later, which was in the outskirts of Pittsburgh, and the crew was so harsh on her. The first week of filming that she stood up on, I heard she stood up on a chair at lunch and formally apologized for her comments.
Darkest day in Steeler history was when another celebrity, Justin Bieber, took the terrible towel. Things ain't been right since he did that. Coincidence or no?
I remember that.
And a lot of players in the moment enjoyed it because they like meeting a celebrity. But I said, this is not a good thing, and history has proven me correct.
So it's kind of the opposite of stomping on the terrible towel. Whoever stomps on the terrible towel, we crush them.
Houshmandzadeh. He paid a steep price for that.
And was it Lendell White when he was on the Titans? He stomped on it.
Lendell White did that.
We destroyed them on a it was a Thursday night game where we unveiled the all-black uniforms, I think, and we destroyed
it hasn't,
them.
It has not treated anyone who disparages the towel very well.
I look forward to that, actually, somebody stomping on the towel, because it's like, we're gonna crush you.
Wonder if we, with your connections, maybe you could get Tom Brady to stomp on it.
Like,
that's what we need.
Get someone, like, you know, in disguise to just throw it under his feet and then film it, yeah. I could probably hook that up.
Let's talk about the picture, because this is admirable stuff that you've done. You could just rest on your laurels. I mean, you're thriving in the business of show, but that wasn't enough for you. You went and wrote your own movie, eh?
I like this narrative. I read a script about 8 years ago and thought it was a really great story to be told. And that movie is out now. It's called Bottom of the Ninth. And as Dave said, it is now the number one, after the first opening weekend, it's the number one sports movie on iTunes. We're top five drama. I think we're top 25 overall and moving up. So we're doing really well. It was like a lot of hard work getting that film into shape, getting it up, getting it cast, getting the money for it. Independent filmmaking in today's day and age is a very, very tough job. Before, you know, this film probably would have been a studio film back in the
80s. Is it turning around, though? Because, I mean, the arc of that in the last, 25 years or so, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, it kind of, that starts the whole revolution. Mm-hmm. And now with connected TV and all that kind of stuff, is it now coming back a little bit or no?
Well, to get people to go to a movie theater to see a movie, you need dinosaurs, you need giant robots destroying a city. The more intimate character pieces where people are doing real acting work, it's really hard to thread that needle and get people to leave their house, because you've got a giant 60, 80-inch screen with surround sound. You've got a movie theater at home. And I think a lot of people in a lot of relationships, like, at nighttime, you have time, you throw something on with your wife or your significant other. And so that's become a thing, and people are starving for that type of content. So, you know, a film like this, or an independent type film that doesn't have giant dinosaurs, generally is something that people consume at home.
That's what you guys do? You and the divine Sofia Vergara. That people, I don't know what people... Well, when you were growing up, what did you think? How different is the life day to day from you growing up in Mount Lebo? What are we? I mean, by the way, do you have those out of body kind of things? Like, I'm married to her and I do movies and all this kind of stuff. I mean, how big a trip is that for you?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, that is a trip. I think I'm very connected to my Pittsburgh roots.
Clearly,
so,
yeah.
So when, you know, it's like, yeah, there was a buddy of mine at lunch was a couple years ago was like, you know, we were talking about manifesting things or what, you know, some hippy dippy thing. And he's like, I just come off of a movie with Pee Wee Herman, where prior to that, I had come off of a movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Like, it was Schwarzenegger, Pee Wee. And then I think I had just started dating Sophia, and they were just like, bro. And I'm like, I know, it's like kind of crazy when you look at it that way. Because yeah, I was a kid who grew up in Mount Lebanon, and really didn't ever want to be an actor. I didn't think about being an actor until high school, when I started writing and making my own films. So that was really, I think, the you know, when that kind of launched for me. But yeah, I was like, you don't think about all this stuff. You can't fathom any of that. You can't fathom being on the field at Heinz waving the terrible towel before a playoff game and having players like, Joe, what's up? You know, or having going out to dinner with Troy Polamalu. Like, you can't, you don't, there's no bucket list for that type of thing. You'd never be so pompous as to wish for that or think that, you know, speak that out loud. Like, oh, I'm going to do that. Like, okay, dude.
But I will say, so you're at Mount Lebo High. You are a three-sport star. And then on top of that, you decide, because that is rarely ambitious for, what, a 16-year-old. I'm going to start writing. I'm going to start making screenplays here.
Well, I think that was what was always actually in my heart. When I was a kid, I was an artist. Like, I just had an artist's, like, soul. Even as a little kid, I was drawing, writing, painting, creating these stories about these characters. I'd tell them to anybody who would listen to me. I was constantly reading. You know, it was, I was also big, you know, and athletic, but I don't think I had my heart set on, you know, there was a kid, Dante Calabria, when I was in high school.
I remember Dante Calabria. Dante Calabria went to UNC, right?
Yeah, exactly. He played for like one of the, I don't know if it was Blackhawk or somewhere in Beaver, one of the Beaver schools. Mm-hmm. And he was a basketball phenom that, yeah, wound up going D1 to UNC and competing for national titles there. And but I remember hearing stories about him that he had the phone. He had a super long cord on the phone before, you know, mobile phones and, portable phones. He had a long cord on the phone out to his backyard. So the phone was there, and he just shot hoops all day long. And that's all he did. And so, and then there was also, like, at Upper St. Clair, there were kids that were coming back 35 pounds heavier over the summer. And you know what was going on. You know, it was a really competitive football area and basketball area, and I knew what it took to be excellent and do what those guys did or move on to the next level. And I wanted to be an artist, you know, and I was going to use sports to get a better education and go somewhere and play. I was going to play basketball. At the end of high school, I was going to want to play in basketball and go into criminal justice, and I was going to go into federal law enforcement. Hmm. But like in Mount Lebanon, you use sports to get to the better school, to get the better education. And so that was my path, but I threw it all out the window because I just knew I wasn't going to be happy or satisfied unless I was doing something artistic and working that side of me out.
What's more fun then, now that you are on the other side, to be a part of, what's more satisfying or however you want to sort of couch it, to be a part of a series that's doing well or to be a part of a blockbuster picture?
Well, you know, I guess it's a little bit of both. You know, being on a really successful series is great because you have security. You know, as an actor, it's when you're unemployed 90% of the time, you're always looking for work and what's your next gig, and you always think the gig that you're on is going to be the last one you ever do. It's just that never goes away. You have breaks from it, but then it comes back. So, you know, that's great. The other side of it is sometimes you can get stuck on something that isn't going your way. And what I mean by that is,
I hear you.
They're not writing your character that year. Mm-hmm. And so that can get really frustrating because there are other things in film, for example, that are passing you by that you could have done or could have competed for. And so, you know, I think it's the nature of the artist to want to keep changing and shifting, you know, roles and keep exploring this versus that. But I also do like the challenge of, over a five-year span, taking a character, arcing a character from here, you know, because there's arcs within a season, there's arcs within episodes, and there's arcs within the entire series of the show. So that's kind of a fun challenge.
It's funny, that's what movies are becoming then, especially with you in the Marvel Universe now, right? Isn't that...
I started in Marvel, and then my character Deathstroke appeared at the end of Justice League, which was the DC universe, which is the other.
I get confused. That's more Eddie Spaghetti back there.
That's what I'm here for.
He knows some stuff, but he's the one who told me the bad pronunciation, so you could blame him for that.
Is that right?
That's not true. That's not true at all.
Don't embarrass me, Spaghetti.
Look at these notes,
Joe. Right now,
I'm done my job.
But, I hear you about that. But speaking of transformation, I'm fascinated and always have been since American Werewolf in London and Thriller. Are there any tips you could have for anybody else who might have to, in the future, acting tips here, transform from human into beast?
Wow. That's a really good question.
Because I like that. Like, yeah, you know, like it hurts when it happens.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure somebody has there been a pleasurable werewolf transformation?
I don't know.
Transformation?
Why is there one where it's like,
ooh, you know, like.
Yeah, let's do this. Hey, all right. You know, why?
Yeah,
why?
No, it's
why
always
why
so painful. Like, no, not again. And then you go.
Because you don't want to be the werewolf?
The way that I rationalized it was that you have organs inside of you that have to change shape, and they're then pushing against bones, which are changing pushing against, you know. So I always thought that it was actually the physical part of the transforming that was like really rough.
Like you can feel like every digit when it's stretching out and all that, and like your teeth grow like,
yeah.
Was that good? What? How did you say that?
This is
like that. Have you ever noticed that some people, not necessarily that
like
they're
you
not
were trying to pass a Primanti sandwich, or about three.
I may have.
Yeah, fair enough.
Have you ever noticed that some human beings, they may not be they look like they're not maybe turning into werewolves, but they're turning into some other beast. Have you ever noticed like 40 like that? He's 60% human, 40% swine.
Like
you ever
in, like in that, real like, life?
Yeah, in real life. Some people like have that like in between thing.
Yeah, totally.
You know?
Yeah.
Like spaghetti's like 30% swine, you know? Not there yet.
I think everybody to some degree looks like some type of animal. I mean,
which one do I look like?
It's interesting. Maybe like a nice Wolverine.
Oh, okay.
Like a friendly Wolverine. Like if you're in a book about like anthropomorphic animals.
Uh-huh.
And they were like, oh, let's go to Mr. Wolverine's house. And they went to Mr. Wolverine's house for tea.
I'm misunderstood.
Sandwiches.
Like I'd be an interesting personification of that metaphor of like just misunderstood. Like you think I'm bad because I'm a Wolverine, but I'm actually kind of cool.
Come on in. I've been waiting for you to
knock
on my
door.
No one ever visits
here,
me
Dave.
Because they think I'm mean.
Right.
Come on in. Yeah, that guy.
You can take that and run with that. Do whatever you want to do with that. It's my gift to you.
It's too bad True Blood wasn't running. We'd have like were Wolverines and you'd be first on the casting
list. Tell us,
list.
From what I know, I have not gotten to watch the movie yet. I intend to as soon as we finish here. I'm not even going to leave this studio. We're going to put it on this screen right here and we're going to have a watch party.
Is that true?
Maybe not. But I will watch it by end of week.
All right.
So it's about, so you go to the joint.
Yeah.
And then you get out 17 years later. It's kind of Roy Hobbs-y, right? From The Natural.
There's some Roy Hobbs in there. Yeah. You know, I loved the way that The Natural didn't explain the missing years. You know, there was something about that, because I think what we're talking about is a redemption story, and you're talking about somebody who makes a mistake when he's very young. And yeah, for people that don't know, so in the film I play a 19-year-old kid who grows up in the Bronx in the shadow of Yankee Stadium and winds up getting drafted by the Yankees. He's this baseball phenom, the pride of all the Bronx. And one night he's out with his neighborhood buddies and they get into a fight with this other group and he hits a kid and the kid falls backwards, smacks his head on the curb and dies. And so he winds up getting 9 years in prison for that and then winds up getting basically a double sentence for violence in prison. For keeping himself alive. You know, it's like handsome kid goes into prison at, you know, 19 and like, you know, you got to do what you got to do to like, you know, keep yourself safe. So he gets out in his late 30s, returns to the Bronx, missed his mother's funeral, missed the Yankees, missed his life basically, and then starts trying to put it back together. He's working a crummy parole job at a fish market and he winds up bumping into, well, his old coach comes to see him, who is now coaching in the minor leagues, and offers him a job coaching with him, assistant coaching. And so that he winds up getting this second chance at baseball through that in this, there's a practice and this rehabbing Cy Young pitcher, former Cy Young winner who's down in the minors rehabbing, played by Brian Wilson without the beard. So it's a beardless Brian Wilson, yeah. And through this series of like circumstances, winds up in this pitching batting duel with Brian Wilson's character, Roger Peterson. And everyone winds up seeing that he's still got it and he can still hit. So the coach gets him a spot on the minor league team riding the bus in his late 30s. He has to get it okayed with his parole officer and goes out and winds up getting this second chance. But it's really a second chance for him to work out his karma and work out his feeling that he doesn't deserve good things in his life. And during that through that process, he winds up bumping into the girl whose heart he broke at 19 when he went into the joint. And that's played by my wife. And we're older now, looking back at our lives. And it drums up how my character going to prison affected both of our lives and our trajectories. And we never really got our lives on track. And maybe it's a second chance for us, too, to have something that we thought was never going to be there.
So it really does sound, in broad strokes, at least simplistically, it sounds like it is like a gritty The Natural. The Natural is a fairy tale where he hits it, where he comes back and tears covers off of baseballs, and he strikes out a few times. He either hits home runs or he strikes out in every at-bat that we see
in
the
movie. I think we're talking about redemption is the theme that's at the core of both. We're talking about, you know, the tragedy of youth, and we're talking about mistakes that people make when they're young, and this feeling that sets in that the best years are behind you, and that you broke this thing beyond repair, and that you're not going to have an opportunity ever again to utilize that talent that made you so special in the first place. And I think that's a universal theme. That's not a sports movie theme. That's just, I think there's a lot of people out there who have regrets and maybe made mistakes, or maybe thought, if I could go back in time and just change that one thing that I did, maybe that would have changed my life, and maybe I would have been something, or maybe I would have done something with this. And I don't think that ever goes away. And I think that this movie is an exploration of that, and in a realistic, gritty way, you know, how somebody could maybe break that karma, or break that pattern, and how difficult the burden of that those types of mistakes are on people. I think it's cathartic, you know.
Well, I mean, it sounds compelling, and here's a clumsy little transition. I do, in my dumb world, I do something called the NFL, where I go back in time and make things right with things that went wrong or went differently than maybe some fans would have liked. Yeah. What for you as a Steelers fan? Go back in time, reverse the moment. What was the worst moment in Pittsburgh sports history, at least
worst
in Joe's, and we can switch it and we can rewrite history?
Well, there's two that immediately spring to mind, or three. Two are in one game and one's in another. I mean, there's two that I would say, and this is beating a dead horse at this point, but Super Bowl 30, those two Neil O'Donnell interceptions.
I'm with you on that.
You know, without minus those interceptions, which were to the same guy in the same spot on the same broken play, what happens if, you know? And then we win number five, and we're 5-0.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
that's right.
I think
that broke the mystique.
Yeah. You know, there's the San Diego AFC Championship game.
I was in Three Rivers for that one. The thing about that, though, is that they would have gotten whipped by the Niners in that Super Bowl, probably. And so maybe we were spared on a grander stage an embarrassment. We wouldn't want that.
Rashard Mendenhall's fumble, the sixth turnover in Super Bowl 45. We had five turnovers. And that second half, the defense turned to concrete. It was like they had just, the first half, they'd just been pouring the cement mix into the ground. And second half, it just locked up. They couldn't move. And we had five turnovers, and everybody knew we were going to win that damn game, and then that fumble happened.
Same thing as Super Bowl 30. One of the great defensive performances in Super Bowl history is after Michael Irvin's touchdown gets reversed.
Mm-hmm.
From that point on, for 45 minutes, the Steelers take away, in a way that no other team did during that Cowboys dynasty, they stopped Emmitt Smith and they took away Troy Aikman. They didn't do anything the rest of that game, and were it not for Neil O'Donnell's picks there, the Steelers vanquish the Titan of the early 90s, their old nemesis, the Cowboys.
So I know that's the game, you know, that's a game we're playing. I mean, the other one is like last year, you know, I mean, well, the past 2 years, we've had NFL owners meeting rule change that led to rule changes last year for pass interference. So, you know, the Joe Hayden ridiculous call in that. In the Saints game.
You want to play what if with that? I've done it with Joe Hayden as well. That call doesn't happen. Antonio Brown is still on the Steelers.
Stays on the team. Exactly.
Because they make the playoffs. There's no fight.
He doesn't skip on a Bengal week when we need... Yeah, exactly. So, or he blows up in another way because that wasn't the first time, you know? So, I don't know. It's hard. Or the Jesse James catch.
That,
I mean, Jesse James catches, we're in the number one seed.
Like, number one seed, the Jags, right. The Jags and Patriots clash in the divisional round.
That's right.
The survivor comes to Heinz Field. That's absolutely
right.
Correct.
So, man, there's a lot. But look, I mean, I'm gonna swing to the positive side, which was, you know, I was at Super Bowl 43 in Tampa when we beat Kurt Warner, my friend, who I was rooting for right up until that game. You know, the James Harrison interception. Which, you know, that was kind of a botched. James was not supposed to drop into coverage. He showed rush, but then, like, just didn't. Drifted, well, had the presence of mind to drift back into the passing lane. And then, you know, we needed 3 points. On the final drive, we needed 3 points to tie that game. And I spoke to Ben about that last drive.
Ben who?
You know.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
The big guy. And the play before the Santonio Holmes catch, the historic catch, he missed Hines Ward wide open.
Oh, and, really? I didn't know that.
And that was in his brain. So he comes back to the huddle and is like, oh, I had him wide open. We could have won. But he was playing to, like, not make a mistake because all we need is the field goal. Let's play for the tie. And so he had that in his brain when he came out. And then threw into triple coverage at the back of the end zone. He said that when he left his hand, he had that sinking, sick feeling that he threw into triple coverage. There's no way. It's an interception. He's going to lose the game, and all we needed was three. And, of course, you know, the rest is history.
Unfair or fair in your book, some of the criticisms we've heard? Because you're, you know, obviously, you tell stories that mostly have happy endings. It seems to me that we've over-mythologized quarterbacks in the 21st century. Brett Favre is the swaggering matinee guy who everybody wants to play for.
Sure.
And Tom Brady is. But I don't think that exists in reality in 31 other locker rooms in the NFL. Now, I don't think every quarterback is beloved amongst the other guys.
Okay, and the question is,
do you think that it's unfair that it seems to me, and perhaps I am wearing a chip on my shoulder because I support the Steelers, I think that the way that Roethlisberger's described probably could apply to, like I say, 30 other guys that are the starting quarterbacks. Okay, universally beloved, and leader of men, and gives speeches in the huddle that make guys play above their abilities and so on.
Well, I think times change. You know, I think what was passable for Joe Namath is no longer passable, clearly. I think that things that athletes got away with even in the 90s, I think the media sought to cover a lot of those things up. And even what the president did, I think we covered up a lot of those things. And I think that living in today's era, especially with things going so fast and just getting eyeballs on stories rather than even telling the truth, I think has led to an era where, you know, I mean, unless you're a saint, somebody's going to pull something up on you or say something about you. And there's going to be an audience, a hungry audience for that, where I think before you wanted to hide it. There was an importance put on having Michael Jordan be Michael Jordan. That was important to society. It was important to us before. And now I think we live in a time where, you know, I'm sure the biggest story of the year that year was the Ray Rice video. You know, that's newsworthy, you know, and should that be said, and are we trying to make a better world out of exposing videos like that and players like that? And, you know, I thought we were, but then Tyreek Hill happened, so now I'm not sure where we're at, and I don't know what we're doing, you know? So, I mean, as far as the quarterback thing goes, it's like, yeah, I've heard it said a lot of times that he's the CEO of the company, but I think there's a backlash against that because I think that people see companies and CEOs as them versus us, or us being the players, and the player somehow who's making X millions of dollars is now the common man, you know, like battle against those owners and get that money, which is a very interesting position.
You know, Phil Rivers is the one guy, and maybe Baker Mayfield is the other one. That's exactly right. This whole, it's so beaten into their heads that you're the CEO, and that, by the way, you know, in the short term, if you say something before a game, it's going to be bulletin board material, and it's not worth it. I'm all for, excuse me.
You getting choked up, or is this?
Phil Rivers, what he does, moving. That's what's fun. This aversion to charisma. That's basically what it's led to is NFL QBs behaving like senatorial candidates, and there's nothing fun about that. Yeah, I don't want anything to come back to bite me.
But isn't that the Bull Durham thing?
Yeah,
but you know what I mean? That's the whole point of Bull Durham. It's like, don't say anything they can put on a bulletin board.
The two things, I mean, one, if Muhammad Ali was in his prime right now, imagine that. I mean, there's nobody ever funnier. Namath is maybe number two in terms of he's the coolest NFL guy in history, but he couldn't do the things he was doing in the late 60s. And Ali, for everything but the sense of humor, he would be 100 times the star he already was. And then on the other hand, to your point, Fats Holmes in Pittsburgh is bipolar or whatever he was, and he thinks a police helicopter is following him, and so he starts shooting from his car at the police, and it's a charming anecdote. Oh, they were different back then, right? If somebody did that now, I mean, society would halt.
It's a terrorist attack.
What? Yeah. Wait, what? A football player did what now?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, and I think it's just, you know, it's the zeitgeist, you know, but I think that we're still talking about a league where, you know, you don't want your quarterback making bulletin board material, you know, and I think part of being a leader of men or the CEO of the team is keeping the drama levels low. You know, I don't think it's your job as a quarterback to raise drama levels. Now, of course,
melodrama, I'm with you. You don't need internal strife, but I think it's fun. I think talking bad about rivals and stuff,
that's all fair game.
That's good with me.
Listen, my formative years were Smash Mouth. They were Steelers versus Ravens. Their bodies are being taken off of the field. You know, like the classic example is that Ravens-Steeler game where James Harrison went off. It was like his coming out party, where it was like 10 tackles, 3.5 sacks, like an interception, a fumble recovery. He knocked Ed Reed out cold. Like, I loved those games. You know, Ryan Clark hitting Willis McGahee so hard that, like, they just dropped to the ground. Like,
I've talked to Ryan. That's Creed Balboa, too.
Ugh.
Yeah, they both go down, and Clark barely can get to his feet and stumble off to his sideline.
It was so bad.
I've talked to Ryan Clark about that game. It is the nastiest game I've ever seen. The Steelers not cold. Three Ravens in that game. Lima Swede, the biggest play he ever made for the Steelers, knocking a Raven cold in that game.
That's right.
And that's right after Polamalu's pick six, the greatest play in Heinz Field history. And then the head-on collision of Ryan Clark and Willis McGahee. And I remember legitimately in that moment thinking, Well, this is going to spoil the party that Willis McGahee has just been killed on the field. I really thought that that's what had happened.
Yeah, it was like you felt
the way
bad
they
about
reacted.
Cheering.
They're like,
yeah.
Oh,
you didn't want to clap because it's like there might be someone might have just expired before your very
that's
eyes.
That's what it looked like. The way they reacted, like, oh, that was
it
above
was,
and beyond.
A big hit is like, okay, so Ryan Clark on Wes Welker. Wes Welker flies about 10 yards that way. Like, ooh, good hit, but he got the worst of that one. Like. The worst hits in the NFL are the ones that are 10-yard or more running start, both of them, you know, bulls just boom, mm-hmm. and nobody flies backwards, just boom.
Rivalries drops. Are good for sports. Parody is not
so that was a beauty. I loved it when they used to talk smack. I used to love that, you know? I mean, can't wait. Bart Scott, come on. Like, those are like the best, you
That's
know?
That's exactly right.
Rex Ryan, Jets games, those are like, those
right.
are so
I
great.
Could talk to you forever. Spaghetti, is this going all right so far? No, it's not, huh?
Sorry, my microphone issue. I wish it was going for another hour or so, but we have, unfortunately, Joe was.
The way he reacted there, I got worried. Like
I thought he was crying, too. No. I thought it was like tears of like,
I
love those games.
Like this mic.
I love those games.
No, he's a Giants
Hines Ward should be in the Hall of Fame.
No, he's a Giants fan, and he thinks that Eli Manning is as good as Ben Roethlisberger. So let's.
There
is that
was
true?
A,
you think that? Come
there
on.
Was a moment where that argument could have been made, yeah. but no Ben just led the league in passing last year. So I think, you know, if Eli can do that this year.
He won't. It'll be a bad year for Eli, and Daniel Jones will play. So, but I'll admit defeat after the season's over.
But I like Eli. I was at Super Bowl 46 when the Giants took down the Pats. My brother and I went. Who was 6'7", 2 inches tall, and we were dressed head to toe in Steeler gear. We looked like it was Halloween, and we were walking around at that Super Bowl going, so you play these things without us? And the whole weekend. And, you know, and I became a huge Eli Manning fan in that game.
Yeah.
I wasn't already.
Well, yeah, he at least that's the bemusing thing, I guess, about Tom Brady's Patriots is you can make a strong case that they could have 10 Super Bowls. If Eli... As my pal Ross Tucker has pointed out, if Olivia and Archie Manning don't meet at Ole Miss, then Tom Brady does have double-digit rings now without Peyton and Eli in the picture.
So let me just pitch this. I don't even know if I want to pitch this on the air. I might want to do this.
Let's hold that back, yeah. Let's surprise America with it
just
later.
Just had an idea for like a 1 hour film or like Perfect. A 2 hour, like maybe like a TV event.
Ooh, I like TV events.
Yeah, okay. Out of something you just said.
Do they still do TV events? It feels like those went out in like 83, 84-ish.
We're gonna bring it back, man.
I just saw Family Ties that opens with that it's a very special Family Ties. It's
very special.
It's when Uncle Ned, AKA Tom Hanks
was drinking Robitussin or vanilla extract in the kitchen.
Look who knows his stuff, see? Look who knows
the alcoholism episode.
And he makes, that's right. And he makes Alex P. Keaton, he makes him a maraschino cherry glass at 2 a.m. And then like Alex P. Keaton's like, I'm cramming for a test, Uncle Ned. I don't know what you're doing. And then he drinks the extract and, you know. Then he gives Alex, imagine this in a sitcom. In a sitcom, by
Go
the way.
On, I'm listening.
He gives Alex P. Keaton, his beloved nephew, the back of his hand. Like he knocks him to the floor like Ryan Clark on Willis McGahee.
Well, do you remember...
What kind of sitcom is this?
Do you remember, like, on I Love Lucy? Like, you know, Ricky was always, like, threatening to spank Lucy. And then they would go to commercial and come back, and Lucy would be at work, like, rubbing her butt, like something just happened.
Yeah,
you know what
right.
I mean? There was a lot of implied spanking.
What about the weird implication of Jack Tripper... He has a waterbed and his own bedroom, and in the room next door, he has his concubines, essentially, in single beds. They share a room, the two girls do, and, you know, Jack and his pal Larry Dallas are around Santa Monica. They're just going to the Regal Beagle and chasing girls every night, but when either one of those women tries to have a date, they disrupt it. What's in your business if your roommate's having a date?
It's like one click of the dial from that movie, The Room, with Brie Larson.
That's right.
It's like one click. If it was a kid in there.
And what's with Mr. Roper's range in point of view about society? He on one hand, he's backwards enough. Like men, single man living with single women, I won't have it. Oh, he's gay. I'm cool with that. That's a weird paradox for a character. And even weirder, Mr. Furley, who replaces Mr. Roper, has the identical worldview. Strange.
That was the most deep dive sitcom rant I may have ever heard. And damn it, if I'm not going to go pitch HBO, like, we need to take, like, imagine having, you know, time capsule sitcoms where you just go back and this is what it was like back then.
2 hours. It's now a 2 hour TV event.
Like the Honeymooners. Bang, boom, you know, like, that was, it was just a different.
I'm with you. Hey, Eddie Spaghetti. Hey, Joe.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've dropped a couple of metaphors along the way and in our conversation. And, you know, one of them is, will you or won't you touch that with a 10-foot pole? Now, everybody talks bravely with the figurative 10-foot pole. I now hold and I'm handing to you
I take the pole.
Literal 10-foot pole.
Okay. All right.
The literal. You know about that because you did that dance movie.
I did. Yes.
Right?
10-foot pole Richie, I believe.
Did you guys ever talk about, like, with the other guys on that show where, in that movie where you're like, I mean, technically, I think the women would like me best. Was that like a competition amongst yourselves? Like, who's the most handsome?
No, man.
No?
Not really. No. I think it was like a boy band. Like, we all had our own thing that we did. You know, everybody has their own personality. Different groups of girls come to see the different.
I mean,
different,
the old guy.
He was a WWE champion.
Okay.
But Big sexy Kevin Nash. He was like with Pam Anderson in the day. Like, I mean, he was the man. Like, listen, my mom was in love with Kevin Nash. Okay.
Really?
So, like, he's got his demo.
And Channing Tatum, because to me, it probably comes down to the two of you.
Channing's the
dancer. If it's like a rivalry.
Channing's the dancing guy. He's like the dancer guy.
Right.
You know, let's call it that. You know, like, and then I'm like the.
You're just like,
the funny guy.
I don't even need to dance. I'm just going to stand.
Well, my character's name does a lot of the work. You know what I mean? That's also one of the reasons why you take a role like that. Mm-hmm. Really, in the grand scheme of life,
do you feel
it's
weird?
A gift in a lot of ways.
I can't imagine. I mean, obviously, look at me. I don't have to tell you this. I can't imagine what it must be like for somebody to approach you about a movie where it's like, yeah, because it's understood that you're super handsome. Is that what it's like? Is it like, am I handsome enough to be considered super handsome?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, what do you ask it? I mean, it's a male stripper movie. It's a male stripper movie.
I know, but I'd like to be. I always envy like what it must be to be George Clooney and like, well, of course you don't live in the reality that we live in. Like, of course you walk in and everybody was like, oh my God, who's that guy? Like,
well,
you know?
Listen, man. I mean, I'm gonna just like stop you right there. Like, you know, nobody. Like, my assistant didn't go to the gym for me twice a day, 6 days a week for 10 months out of the year while I was on juggling True Blood and Magic. That's a lot of work. You know, you're training like a professional athlete. You're eating like a professional athlete. You're sleeping like a professional athlete. Like, it's a lot of work.
I've been doing that for the last 11 years.
I mean, so you
know.
That's
how I live.
So, like, you know, it's a lot of work. And so... You know, when someone calls you up and is considering you for that, I mean, yes, that's a part of it, but it's also Steven Soderbergh. So, you know, this is like, if Steven Soderbergh he's not shooting that movie or directing that movie, or Greg Jacobs isn't directing the second one, I'm not doing it. We're not doing it. It's not interesting to me. You know, it was done in a really subversive and funny way. There was a huge joke. And actually some statements on society being made, and we were in on it. And that was really fun to be a part of, this subversive, interesting. You know, and True Blood was kind of the same way. It was Alan Ball. It was a bunch of people with Oscars and serious hardware doing, like, tackling a very fun, high-concept topic, but then doing it really well. So, you know, when you're involved in a production like that, it's like, you want to give it your all. So, of course, you're going to hit the gym harder than you've ever hit. You want to come in correct, because I just like the challenge, you know? I mean, the film's going to live forever. I might as well come in and let's go all the way in every way possible.
Do you think, so by that comparison, don't you think that a little bit too much has been made about the actors who were in Saving Private Ryan, that they went to boot camp for 3 days? They go, they, that was, I'll never forget that. That was tough. And Hanks, we wanted to leave after the first night, but Hanks said no. He became the captain. He made us stay for that. It's like, you were there for a couple nights, fellas.
Yeah, I think actors are very sensitive people to begin with, so I think they are prone to, this was incredible, but you know, I mean, I've worked with Navy SEALs, I've worked with like DevGru guys, I've done ride-alongs in South LA with Inglewood Narcotics, like, you know, I've worked with bad dudes, and you know, in another lifetime, could I maybe have gone down one of those roads? Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, but did I? No. So am I going to walk around and say, I went through Navy SEAL training? No, I'm not, because I didn't. And those guys did. And it's a slap in the face to say that, you know, you did that. But, you know, I think when you get into an ensemble, that's the interesting thing about acting is you get into this ensemble and you start bonding, you start forming, and then you start taking on that role to the group. So I've been in situations where I've been the Navy SEAL squad leader, and it is my job to work out harder. It is my job when we're running to be out in front. It is my job to be there before everybody else and leave afterwards and do one extra, you know, because that's what a leader does. And then if you're doing your job right, those other castmates, they will say about you what they say about Tom Hanks, which was, he became the captain, he was the man, because their character needs that to, you know, that's what you need to, and it worked, you know?
I could hear about this anyway. Endlessly. I get it. No, I listen. It really is fascinating.
What did you just pull out?
All right, so, like I say, people are courageous about what they won't touch with a 10-foot pole when it's figurative. You now, at another level, a literal 10-foot pole. Will you touch this statement with a 10-foot pole? Joe, Baker Mayfield, in 2019, is the best quarterback in the AFC North.
It's not true. I'm not touching.
You're not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole?
No, I'm going to touch this table instead.
Not Andy Dalton? We're Lamar Jackson. Oh, we're going with number 7 then.
Yeah, man. All I mean, come right. on. That guy's...
Okay, good. I like where your head's at on that.
You have to prove yourself. You got to prove yourself. And when you prove yourself, it's put it and put the money in my hand. Put the money... I'm not saying there isn't potential or that people aren't great or that they're not going to have a great career or they're not capable of great things, but put it in my hand.
Here's the thing that I find fascinating, and we'll have to wait and see how it plays out here, is, I mean, you have a bunch of alpha guys in Odell, Jarvis Landry likes his touches, Baker Mayfield. Mm-hmm. Freddie Kitchens, who's never been a head coach, is the guy who is going to resolve all of those locker room issues and take them to success. That's, I mean, they are loaded, by the way. The Browns are a loaded roster.
Absolutely. But that's what happens when... I mean, that's what happens. That's what happens over time when you get to draft super high. You get those guys. You have a ton of talent. I mean, look, Pat Riley stepped into a very talented team in the early 80s and did well with that. You're breaking a culture. He also did well with that with a team that had won previous championships and had a guy in Kareem Abdul-Jabbar who had won before. There were people on the team that had won. I mean, Magic won his first year. Like, they had touched that. They kissed it. They know what it took. Mm-hmm. You're talking about a culture and a team and an organization that has never won. And I'm not talking about the Ravens. I'm talking about this iteration of the Browns. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about breaking culture, and that is sometimes a very tough thing to do in a sustainable way. Look at the Jaguars. Everybody thought the Jaguars were going to come out last year and, like, they had turned a corner.
Well, the majority of the smarts out there who talk about football for a living will tell you the Browns are the team to beat in that division. There's another team that's won a number of AFC North titles named the Pittsburgh Steelers. They are the underdog now. Touch this with a 10-foot pole, will you? The underdog Steelers will win the AFC North in 2019.
Trying to knock down this shelf over here.
Knock down whatever you want. That's right!
Yeah.
You did it, Joe.
That's right.
You think the Steelers, and why? Not just because you want to see it happen. Tell me why you think this team, minus 84 and 26, is somehow better or at least good enough to claim the division this year?
Well, I think the other team, at least last year, that was challenging to the Steelers were the Ravens, but I don't think their quarterback, I think their quarterback has a lot to prove in the throwing department. I don't know how sustainable the running quarterback, running offense is going to be, especially in a second season when people have tape. Unless he grows tremendously, they can figure him out. I mean, Colin Kaepernick, I mean, it's a hot button topic, but that was a classic example. Like, nobody had a better, you know, out of the gate jump than that guy did, and they figured him out.
Well, and the defense has very likely regressed there in Baltimore ever so slightly, which takes away the margin of error.
Yeah.
If you want to play nip and tuck like the Ravens did all through the second half of the season,
sure.
They are going to have to put more points up. But the Browns, though, I don't know. You know, we've discussed them. I think the secret weapon for the Steelers this year is specifically on that defense, that front three, Tuitt, and Hargrave and Hayward. There's not a ton of depth there, but they dominated the second half of the season.
Yeah.
And if on the back end now, with some of the fixes they've made and Hayden providing the stability back there, I think the defense has a chance to be a top five defense.
They have a chance, yeah. They've shown the promise of that, and now it's just can it be consistent for an entire season? Can we also come out of the gate strong? You know,
that's a tough one. Patriots at Patriots, yeah. Seahawks at San Francisco. That's a rugged.
And we hit our
game.
Stride traditionally later on in the season, which has fared well for us in terms of deep playoff, you know, like, you know, in Super Bowl runs. But I think, I'm optimistic. I'm also optimistic about who we drafted. And I'm optimistic about those pizzas stepping in. I hope that the angst created by all the talk of distractions last year, I hope that puts a chip on everyone's shoulders and that they're going to come out strong with something to prove.
That's right. Well, no, yeah, listen, no team has won a title in any sport in a quarter century with people outside the locker room believing in them. If you listen to the players in that locker room, they're the only ones who believe in it happens to be true with the Steelers in 2019. I couldn't be more excited for a Steelers season. Last thing, I went to Kennywood a couple weeks ago.
No way.
Have you been to on the Steel? Are you going to make a trip to ride the Steel Curtain?
I'd love to. I'm going back for I'm on the board at Pittsburgh Children's, and I'm going back for an event in early August. So, man. Well, let me ask you this. Do they have Heinz ketchup in the park or what? Because there was a scare. They fixed it?
That was a disgrace.
Man.
And the people of Pittsburgh rose up
you
about
can't have
what's important.
Potato patch fries with Hunts?
No.
Get out of here.
No.
Come on.
Dave, last question is, what's your meat of choice at Primanti's?
Meat of choice? I'm a steak and cheese guy, but I also like the Genoa salami. I took my wife, Sophia, and she had the turkey and cheese, which I was like, they have turkey here?
It's a weird choice.
Yeah, but like it was I think it was more like a lighter. Like I know I'm walking into a situation with French fries on the sandwich, so I'm going to pick the lighter choice. And I was like, look.
Don't embarrass me.
Well, please. I said, right. You know, Hillary Clinton came here on her campaign trail for a photo op. And she left without eating the sandwich. And it was a huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that led to her to Pittsburgh or Pennsylvania switching to a red state, but that might have been it. That
You're
might
not
have been
naive,
what it came
right.
down to. You talk about going back in time and changing things. You want to change that election. You make Hillary eat the Primanti Brothers sandwich.
At least
sandwich.
Half of that, right?
Maybe they stay blue,
right.
And then they win. Hmm. But it didn't happen. So I said, you can't do this to me. Do not pull a Hillary. You got to eat this whole sandwich. And she took a first bite, and it was like, she just took another and another and just like wolfed that thing. She loved it.
And now all of a sudden, bottom of the ninth, a big hit. Coincidence? Probably. But I mean, I don't know. Maybe not.
Eat your Primanti Brothers.
And make sure you check out Bottom of the Ninth, starring Joe Manganiello and Sofia Vergara.
Brian Wilson, Dennis O'Hare from True Blood, Michael Rispoli, Vinny Pastore from Sopranos and the Deuce fame. Great, great, great actors. Great bunch of actors in this.
All right. Well, I look forward to watching it, which I will do by week's end. In the meantime, I hope the conversation doesn't end as football season is nigh. If not before, let's see you out at that Chargers game.
At the Chargers home
game?
In
early October. Sunday night football, dude. Yeah, the Steelers home game, exactly. All right, everybody. The great Joe Manganiello.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, pal.
Yeah.